Okay, going to start here with the Mishnah on the bottom of Kuf Yud Tet Amud Bet. The Mishnah says, Shtei Yivamot, Zoha Meretz Meit Bali, V'Zoha Meretz Meit Bali. Each one of them testifies vis-a-vis their own husband and says that their husband passed away, which they are believed about. It happens to be that they're also married to brothers, so it has implications vis-a-vis the other woman. And therefore over here, Zoj Asura Mipnei Balat Shel Zu, they each are still bound here because of the problem of Yibum. So even though they testify vis-a-vis their own husband and they're believed for their own husband, they're not believed about the fact that their own husband now impacts on their Yivama, their sister-in-law, who then would be released by this because Yivimta is one of the individuals who is not believed when it comes to testifying for someone else. Now, lezo edim, velozo en edim. One of them has edim, one of them does not have edim. Et sheyeshla edim, asura. The one who has edim is actually in the worst situation, because the edim, in terms of her husband passing away, she was believed anyway. She doesn't need the edim for that. The edim helped the other woman, because now she testified about her own husband and is released from that. The edim helped her now be released from the fact that she has a yavam. Et sheyeshla edim, muteret. But on the other hand, the one who does not have the Edim, she's the one who's muteret now, because again, vis-a-vis her own husband, she's believed, the Edim help her with the Yavam. But the woman who has the Edim, her own husband, yes, we know that he's not around, but she has no evidence about the Yavam. Lezo banim, lezo ein banim. One of them has children, one of them does not have children. Et sheyesh la banim muteret. The one who has children is released, because she's believed about the death of her husband, and now the fact that she has children releases her from Yibum. On the other hand, v'che'en labani masurat, the one who does not have children is still stuck in the waiting for Yibum problem, and she can't be released because her brother-in-law, we don't know for certain, is dead because we only have his wife testifying about that. Nityabmu umeitu hayivamim asurot li'inasei. If they did Yibum, and then the Yivamim died, those that performed Yibum with them, they're still asurot li'inasei because we don't know if there are other Yivamim out there. We don't know anything about their other brother-in-law. So as far as the people that they know here, the Yavam that they performed Yibum with, the ones that are present, the woman is believed that her husband passed away. She's believed enough that she's allowed to perform Yibum. But she still has a problem, which is overseas, her brother-in-law was there, who her other sister-in-law is testifying is dead. But nevertheless, we don't have evidence of that, and she's stuck. Once the first Yavam dies, she's still bound by that second Yavam that is overseas. So even though, amazingly, we're allowing her to perform Yibum based on her testimony, we're not going to allow her to be released based on that testimony. And that's what Rabbi Elazar objects to and says, Rabbi Elazar Omer, Hol v'hutru l'yivamin, hutru l'chol adam. If you're going to let them perform Yibum and we're going to allow them to act based on their own testimony, that's enough evidence that they're telling the truth. If they're telling the truth vis-a-vis themselves, then there's certainly it should be good enough for us to depend on that to allow the sister-in-law to be released here, because her Yavam definitely died if we allowed this woman to perform Yibum over here. Now, Tana, lezo edim ubanim, vezo lo edim velo banim, shtehen mutarot. One of them has edim and banim, and the other one does not have edim and does not have children, then they're both mutarot. In that case, they're both mutarot, because the one who is without banim and without edim, she testifies about her own husband that he passed away. As far as her Yavam is concerned, we have Edim to the fact that her Yavam passed away, so she's good. The woman who has the Banim, who has the children, now she testifies about her own husband that he passed away. As far as Yibum is concerned, she's released because she has children. It doesn't matter that we don't have evidence for her about the other individual. Now, Nityabmu, Umeita Yavamin, it's obviously not a continuation of the first case in the Braita, because otherwise you're dealing with Edim and Banim, they can't have Yibum. It's just a new case where two women married to two men that are brothers, and that's the case that it was discussing. It's the same case as at the beginning of the Mishnah. Again, if they perform Yibum here, there are brothers-in-law that are present. If they perform Yibum, and then the Yavamim pass away, Asurim li'inasei, they cannot then get married, because we still have the problem of the overseas Yavam, which only have their own wives testifying about, and is not believable for the sisters-in-law to help each other out. And then the Gemara says, Rabbi Elazar Omer, Ho, v'hutru l'yivamin, hutru l'chol adam. Listen, if you're already going to allow them to perform Yibum, then you're acting on their testimony. If they're acting on their testimony, we got to believe that they're telling the truth. If they're telling the truth, then each one of them releases the other from the obligation of Yibum. So now, Boi Rova. But now Rava queries, my time with Rabbi Elazar, what's the reasoning behind Rabbi Elazar's opinion? Is it very simple that he believes that a co-wife can't testify for her friend? He doesn't have the five women not to be believed. And he allows a tzara, a co-wife, to testify here. Now, it's a quasi-co-wife. Yeah. It's a co-wife-to-be, or a yivimta, as we called it in the Mishnah. Someone who is a potential co-wife. But either way, maybe he has this belief against the position of the Chachamim, that those five women that we disqualify, he does not think that's the case. Or is it because we believe her when she acts on her testimony? We know that the risk with all these women is that they have a bone to pick with the other women. They may be vindictive, and therefore they will cause trouble for the other woman. That's why we don't believe them, because they're going to try to mess up the other woman in order to get her out of the picture. In the situation where she acts on her testimony, then we should believe her because it's clear that she's no longer just going to mess up her co-wife or the other individual here. She's going to mess herself up. And the fact that she's willing to act on it already is evidence of the fact that we should believe her. And that's the other possibility. That's why Rabbi Elazar should be believed over here. Then we would believe her in this instance that not only did her husband pass away, but it's good enough to show that the Yavam has passed away. Gemara says, my nafkamino, what's the difference? Do we allow the co-wife to marry before her? If the reasoning behind Rabbi Elazar's opinion is that the co-wife can testify here, then afagab dlo insiv min savina la litzara. Even though she herself has yet to get married, will marry off the co-wife because she has nemanut legabe the co-wife. If you say the whole reasoning over here is because she does not want to ruin her life, so she might want to ruin someone else's life, but she's not going to do that to herself in the meantime, then insiv min savina la litzara. If she gets married, then after she's married, we'll allow the tzara to get married. Ilo insiv, if she does not get married, lo min savina la, we will not allow her to get married because we need evidence of the fact that she's telling the truth. The best evidence we have is if she gets married based on her own testimony, because that would throw her into a position where she would really be stepping on eggshells, because she'd be in a illicit relationship. If her husband shows up, she'd lose everything. So in that case, we believe the woman. So if she gets married, we can take that as evidence of the fact that she was telling the truth and then extrapolate that to her co-wife. Semai, what is the din? What is the position of Rabbi Elazar? Tashma, Rabbi Elazar omer, hol v'hutru liyavamin, hutru l'chol adam. So that's Rabbi Elazar's statement in our Mishnah and the Braita as well. Since they were mutarot to marry the yavamim, therefore they are mutar l'chol adam. Iyamart bishlama dehi lo mikalkula nafsha, since she will not mess herself up, hainu duchi insiv min savinala. That's why once they marry the yavamim, once they perform yibum, we allow the other one to get married or be released to the public. If you say the whole reasoning here is because a co-wife could testify about another co-wife, if they did not get married, from here you can conclude that time of the Rabbi Elazar mishum de insivu. It's because they got married. And she does want to mess herself up. So from the evidence of the Mishnah, Rabbi Elazar says the reason we allow them now to be freed to the shuk after they form Yibum is because they acted on their testimony. They testified their husband passed away. Now they married a Yavam who's present, who's here, not somebody who's overseas, and they had Yibum with him. If she was really lying to mess up her co-wife or her Yavimta over there, then she wouldn't have gotten married. She wouldn't have performed Yibum over here. The fact that she performs Yibum is evidence of the fact that she really is telling the truth about her husband passing away. But once she's married the Yavam, and now that Yavam dies, now we're going to worry about the fact that she has another Yavam overseas. She married based on her testimony. That should be enough to make us trust her, the gabe her co-wife, the gabe her Yavimta, the other woman that's in this picture. And that's the reasoning behind Rabbi Elazar, that she's not willing to ruin her life in order to ruin someone else's life. Rabbi Elazar, the divrehem gamar. The Gemara says, maybe not. Maybe Rabbi Elazar is speaking in the position of the Chachamim. For me, I don't need any of this because I can have one of them testify for the other and I believe them. And even if they don't get married, I would let her, the other party, get married. According to you, Chachamim, At least agree to me, the hefi the intzev mitzavinla. If she marries based on her testimony and she puts herself in a predicament which would wreck her life if she was lying, then we should believe her vis-a-vis her co-wife, vis-a-vis the Yivim Tawir. Shom dehi lo mikakula nafsha, because she won't mess herself up. Virabonon. And the Rabbanon say, no, that's not the truth, because we saw this on Friday's daf as well. Tomot nafshi im plishtim hu dekavda. She says, listen, I'm willing to go down in order to take her down. I'm willing to ruin my life just to wreck her life. That's how much it means to me. To wreck her life is that I'm willing to give up myself. So same thing here, like by Shimshon, where he pulls down the huge catering hall on himself and says, I'm going to go down, I'm going to take all the plishtim with me. So he's willing to give up his life in order to cause all that damage. And the same thing by this woman. She's willing to give up her life in order to basically ruin it for the other party. This is how vindictive or rational people become in these situations, that she's willing to mimikalkel nafsha in order just to see that her co-wife or yipimta doesn't get step on her territory, doesn't get what she's supposed to get. So the chachamim would disagree even in that reasoning. Natashma, ha'isha shecha hi ubala lemidinat hayam, woman who she and her husband went overseas, uvav amra meit bali, and she comes back and says, my husband passed away, tinase v'titok tubata, she can get married and take her tuba, bitzarata asura, and her co-wife is asur. Again, a mishnah that we saw back on Kuf Yud Chet on Friday's daf. Then Rabbi Elazar Omer, which we don't have in our mishnah, but was part of a braita, Lazomer hold v'hutrahi, hutrina mitzarata. If you're going to release her, then her co-wife should also be released. So if that's the case, it's pretty clear that Rabbi Elazar is saying that the testimony of this woman releases the other woman, has nothing to do with marriage. Ema, no, amend that to read, hoil behutra v'niseit. Because she was mutarit and married based on that, then we're fine. So Gemara says, well, there might be another scenario where even if she gets married, there is some risk here. Why is that? V'lichush dima begita atai. She came with her get. She had got a get. Her husband divorced her overseas. She comes back and says, you know what? My life's wrecked because I got divorced from this guy. I can now wreck the life of my co-wife. You know what I'll say? I'll say that he died. And if he died, we're all going to get married now because he died. I'll get married and so will my co-wife get married. The only difference is I'm really divorced. So my getting married is not because he's passed away. It's because I'm divorced. So I'll get married, but I'll testify that he died and I'll get married.
And he'll show up.
Then he'll show up. I'll be fine because I was divorced from him and I married this other guy. Meantime, the co-wife is trapped. Right, she's in a difficult situation because she was never divorced. So how do we prevent against something like that happening by her basically being divorced but covering up the divorce in order to ruin the life of her co-wife? What says, the camera, the mikavno. And the reason that she's testifying this way is to ruin the life of her co-wife. Idinsiv the Yisrael hochanami. Kumar says, if she marries the Yisrael, so be it. That's right. You would have a problem. Hochamai skin and insiv the coin. She marries a kohen, then it won't work so well, because the kohen is not allowed to marry a grusha. If her husband shows up now, after she's married to kohen, and says, wait a minute, I gave you a get, where's that get? She's going to have to produce the get, and she's going to lose her new husband. She's going to lose out the kohen. So there she has something to lose. There she's going to wreck her life, not just her co-wife's life. But it's true that if you only married a Yisrael, where a get would not matter, then in that situation, she wouldn't wreck her life, and then we'd have questions whether we can believe her directly about her Sarah, because even though she got married, marriage is not evidence of the fact that she is telling the truth. Again, in the other cases where you're talking about the cases of Yibum, that's very different. Because there, in divorce, if she was divorced and married her Yavam, that's Pogeya be'eshet achiv shalbo makom mitzvah, that's a chiyuv karet. So if she does that game with a get, it won't help her over there by Yibum. Because over there, she'll be in violation of a chiyuv karet by engaging with her brother-in-law. So there, you can't say that she's just nothing. It's namikalkal nafsha. There, she's really taking a huge risk involved. Over here, she could take that risk and marry Yisrael and wouldn't be a problem. So you have to look at the circumstances. But the Gemara here is inconclusive then with regards to the positioning of Rabbi Elazar. It first brought something that seemed to prove, like from our Mishnah, that he believes marriage is the determining factor. And that's why we believe them. Then the Gemara said, no, maybe he's speaking in the words of the Chachamim. Then we brought a proof from the Mishnah on Kuf Yud Chet. And then the Gemara there said, no, he meant it to read otherwise. And then the Gemara asked this final question, which is, even according to Rabbi Elazar, the fact that they get married is not always evidence of the fact that she's not willing to ruin her life. In the end, she might be marrying because she got a get, and she's not ruining her life at all. So that's why we said either she marries a Kohen, or it has to be a case of Yibum, where it's obvious that the marriage is clearly an indication that she's telling the truth. If that's the case, then we can use that testimony towards a tzara, according to Rabbi Elazar. One is only allowed to testify about seeing an individual passed away if they saw the face with the nose. Even though you see that there are signs on his body itself, or in his clothing, there you're not allowed to testify. So you have to see the face with the nose so that you can testify with certainty that you saw the individual that passed away. It's not enough to rely on the clothing that he's wearing, and it's not enough to rely on the simanim you see in his goof. The Gemara will discuss why that is. Eimedim elachetetet nafsho. Again, you're not allowed to testify until you know he's absolutely dead. Even if you see him in a position or predicament which almost certainly will lead to death, you're not allowed to testify until you know for sure he is dead. Vafilu ro'o miguyad. Even if you see him, miguyad means sliced up, cut up, where there's a limb that has been cut off, some injury that is probably fatal in almost all instances. Nevertheless, you cannot testify based on that. There are others that have a girsa here, miguyar, which is from yoreh, from chitzim, that is punctured by many arrows, or punctured by the spears, whatever it is, something that seems fatal. Nevertheless, you can't testify until he is dead. Vitzaluv. Now, tzaluv is an interesting word here because the meaning of tzaluv changes over time. So over here, it seems, and Rashi seems to be indicating tzaluv is to be crucified, like they did in the times of the Romans. Now, the Romans crucified people, nothing to do with any religious symbol. It was adopted as a religious symbol because supposedly one of their individuals was put up on a crucifix, and that became the sign of the religion. But the crucifix itself was used by the Romans across the board. It was categorically used as a way to punish people, and in a public manner. It was a painful death, very painful and slow death, but also a very public death. And that's how they punished people in order to deter either rebellion or resistance or whatever problems they were trying to prevent. Now that's in terms of the Roman times. But if you look in the Targum Unculus, the Targum Unculus, the end of Parshat Vayeshev, where Yosef is in prison with the butler and the baker, and then he predicts what the outcomes will be. One of them is going to be restored to their post, and the other one's going to be hanged. Over there, the Targum Unculus of V'talu oto al ha'etz is V'tzalvu oto al ha'etz, that they hung him on the tree. So there again, the word is used for hanging the individual, not for crucifying the individual. So I'm saying the word saluv changes over time. It's probably connected to hanging. Depends what it means to be hanged. Does hanging mean to be hanged like in the sense, true sense of being hanged? Or does it mean hanging like the side of a crucifix? There is clearly in the time of Paro, they're not talking about crucifixion. They're talking about being hanged like you would on a noose and hanging them from the tree. Over here, it's not clear, but it seems, because we're talking about Mishnaic times, that it's likely that we're talking about saluv in the sense of crucifixion. But either way, the point is being that just because you see someone in that predicament doesn't mean they're going to die. Now, with crucifixion, it might be more so. By somebody being hanged, it's a very short period of time before they are dead, and therefore you can assume, you know, if you see them, they're hanging, that they are probably dead. The praise of crucifixion is it takes time. A person can be alive on the crucifix for a day, 2 days, while they are dying. It's a very painful and difficult death. And therefore, this would make more sense. Just because you see him on there doesn't mean that he's going to die, because somebody can take them off. Somebody can remove them. As others indicate over here, that maybe a Roman matron will come by and have mercy on the individual, and she'll have them take him down. So there were these things, there are pleas for mercy where somebody would release the individual from the crucifixion and you could survive the crucifixion. Or the next possibility is that you see a wild animal that's eating him. And so you again assume automatically or that definitely he's going to die here because nobody survives this. In all three of these cases, you're not allowed to testify until you see them dead. Just because you see them in the process which normally leads to death, or is normally fatal, you can't testify, and you can't assume that that's the outcome. That's the whole problem of the dummy that we had with the woman testifying before. We need to know for certain. We don't want you drawing conclusions or using circumstantial evidence to tell us this information. Eimedim ela ad gimel yomim. You can only testify up to 3 days post the death of the individual, because then the body or the face is still recognizable. If it's beyond that period of time, then the body starts to change, meaning it blows up, and it changes it both in color and in structure, and therefore you may not recognize the individual anymore. It'd be too difficult to testify about it. So Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava Omer, lo kol adam, v'lo kol amakom, v'lo kol hashaot shavin. So Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava says, not everybody is the same, not every place is the same, and not every time is the same. You're in places or climates that are hotter, you're in climates that are colder, you have individuals who blow up faster, less fast, depending on how much they weigh, how much fat's involved. There are all these different factors that contribute to the nature or the decomposition of the body or the change in the body. And you can't make a blanket rule that 3 days is the cutoff. It's just not true. Now, obviously today, as you're mentioning, with refrigeration, that changes things dramatically. Now, what the Rabbeinu Tam over here, even before the days of refrigeration, starts to qualify this Mishnah significantly. And he starts to move around and maneuver to say, basically narrow the Mishnah down. If you look at the top Tosafot on the Amud, he says, Perish, Mishum Desham Ve'elech Mishtaneh. Because after that point, the body changes and you can't recognize, you can't testify. V'humir Rabbeinu Tam. Danu Dafka She'en Shem Ela Partsuf. That's only if you only have the face. Ela Kol Gufo Shalem, if you have the whole body, Afilo Ein Kan Padachat V'chotem Nikar Hu Heitev Ayidei Simanei Aguf. If you have the entire body, then you are able to recognize the person, even missing some features or some parts to it. If you have the entire body there, and someone who knows this person well, and can just make an identification, even after a number of days, they can make that identification. That's one. Number two is, and also, if the face wasn't damaged in any way, clearly you can recognize this person even after a number of days. The person doesn't change so much. People are well recognizable after a number of days. So Rabbeinu Tam here quickly narrows this Mishnah down and says, that's all this is when there's not the body attached, where the head is separate from the body. And that's where it's important that you have the whole face and nothing ruined in the face. Beyond that, even if there's nothing ruined in the face, you have the whole body. If the whole body's there, even after a number of days, you can recognize the individual. And same with the face alone. If the face wasn't damaged, even after a number of days, you can recognize the face. And the Rabbeinu Tam is almost taking up the position of Yehuda ben Bava without taking it up. But he's basically saying that not every case here, you can just say 3 days is the cutoff. It depends what you're looking at here that makes a difference. All right, Tan Rabbanan. Padachat velo partsuf panim. Partsuf panim velo padachat. If you have the forehead without the face, or you have the face without the padak, without the forehead. You need the entire face. You need the forehead, which seems to be very integral to the identification of the face, plus the face itself. Now, partsufa panim seems to refer to the cheeks, or the cheekbones, which gives the features of the face. Imachotem with the nose. So those are the three important features that you need. You need forehead, nose, and like the cheekbone area, in order to identify the face, to be able to tell that this is the face. So again, Rabbeinu Tam says that's only when you're talking about the face alone, when you only have the face, and you're trying to identify if it's missing any of these features, you can't identify alone. But if it's attached to the body, and through that all of those pieces together, you can identify it, maybe you don't need all the features of the face. Amar Abayi, v'itemer Rav Kana, Mikro. What is the pasuk? It says, Akarat pneihem antabam, that their faces told the truth about them. Recognition of the individuals, or implicated by the fact of their look or their face, we can tell. Now Rashi says over here that based on that, we learn from that, Alma ene dupishar guf elu beheker panim. That's how you tell somebody apart, is because of the face. Tosafot says that Rashi's explanation is not so simple because it doesn't give you enough information. Rashi says it's just about the fact that you see here that the face is essential to identifying it. Tosafot over here says no, that there's an extraneous statement over here, which is, Perush, Tzarich padachat shel pnehem. And that's why they bring the pasuk. It says, Hakarat pnehem antavam. The Mashal Tzarich Hakara Levad Min HaPanim, that the Hakara is beyond just the Panim. The Hakarat Pnehem means that there's an additional Hakara beyond the Panim. Not only do you need the face, you need the forehead with the face. Two pieces of identification together, exactly. The Hakarat and Pnehem together does it. So Tosafot criticizes Rashi's explanation, but again, the Pasuk is not, I would say, definitive in its proof here. It's just a way to show that the face is integral to the identification of the individual. So now we have a proof of this. Abba Bar Marta. This individual was very poor. He was indebted to the Reish Galuta. The Reish Galuta had lent him money. And the people, the servants of the Reish Galuta, were known to be a little bit zealous in their collections and in their dealing with other people. And he was afraid to walk by the area of the Reish Galuta if they had been seen by them, because they were going to shake him down for money that he didn't have. So what did he do? Aiti Kira. He took wax. Dovak Bivlayata, he put it on a piece of shmata, and Dovak Beapute, And then he put it on his forehead. Similarly, he put the wax and the shmato, or the cloth, on his forehead. Chalav kamayu, he went in front of them. Velo biskru, they didn't recognize him. Lo yikirua, they didn't recognize him at that point. Changed the dynamic of his forehead in that way. The old Botox, or whatever it did, changed the way his forehead looked. But you see from here that the forehead was essential in identifying the individual, and when he did this, they were unable to identify him. Now, it seemingly was that he was not trying to escape paying back, he just didn't have the money right now. And the Reish Galuta trusted him because he was a Talmid Chacham. Just these servants of the Reish Galuta were a little more zealous, and they were shaking him down, so he was trying to escape. Yerushalmi brings a story like this, where there was a whole city trying to get out of the taxation, and they did this, and they didn't recognize them, because every time the tax collectors came around, they would do this trick, and they would get out of having to pay the taxes until somebody was malshin. They got one guy who spilled the beans, and then they came and took out the whole city and took care of the problem. But we see here that they are proving through this that a person can change by simply changing one feature in the face. Again, they're unidentifiable, even by people who know them. And so here, by changing the forehead, they're showing how essential the forehead is to the identification of the individual. Alpha Pishyesh Simanim. Lamamra, from our mission, it sounds like the Simanim, Lab Doraita, that Simanim are not from the Torah, because we only allow you to identify through the facial features, not through Simanim on the goof, and not through clothing. Viraminhi, Matsu Kashur Bikis, Ube Anaki Ube Tabat. We found the get tied to a wallet, to a pouch, or to a signet, to a seal. Oshinimsa ben kelav, or it's found amongst his utensils, among things that he owns. Afilu zman merubeh, even if it's over a long period of time. Kasher, the get or the document is still considered kasher, because the fact that it is attached to something that is clearly identifiable as his gives you evidence of the fact that it is his get and it is the document that he had granted. Amar Abaye, lo kashal. That's not a question. Ha Rabbi Eliezer ben Mahavai, ha Rabbanon. That is actually a machloket, the Tanya. Eimei dim ala shuma. One is not allowed to testify with regards to a birthmark, we'll call it. This is an identifying feature on the individual. Rashi in Bechorot translates this as sometimes as rouge, which is that it's some sort of red mark on the individual. Other places they testify as a being a birthmark of sorts, some sort of discoloration on the body. But either way, the shuma is a siman that this individual has something that you can tell makes them unique in that manner. So Rabbi Lezer ben Ravai Omer, maybe indeed you can use it. Whereas the Tanakam or the Rabbanan say you cannot use it as a means of identification. My la bahaka miflege. What is their machloket? Mar savar simanim de oraita. That Rabbi Lezer ben Ravai must believe that simanim are doraita, and since there's a siman on his body, you're allowed to identify with it. Mar savar simanim de rabbanan. Whereas the Tanakama believes that the siman is only midrabanan, and being midrabanan, you can't use it as a means of identification for the individual. Amarova, Rava disagrees and says, the kuleyama simanim deoraita. Everybody agrees that simanim are mina Torah. Hacha b'shuma mitzuya b'ben gilo kamiflege. They're arguing about this concept that someone born under the same constellation, or under the same part of the zodiac, that they all have this similar type of birthmark or identifying mark on them. Marsava Shuma Mitsuya Beben Gilo, the Tanakama believes that this type of mark is not unique to this individual. It's unique to this individual born on this day under this constellation. That means everybody else born on that same day would have the same identifying mark. Marsava Eina Mitsuya Beben Gilo. And Rabbi Lezer ben Ravai says that's not the case. This is something unique to this individual and only to this individual. It's not something that's common amongst other people who are born under the same part of the zodiac, and therefore it is a good enough identifying mark. Based on that, Rava says that the simanim are doraita. Ve'ikedamrei, some say acha b'shuma asuya lishtanot achar mita kamiflegei. They're actually arguing about a shuma that, because of the stress of death, can change the nature of how it looks. So sometimes the stress of death, or the death itself, causes discoloration, it causes changes in the body, so you can't say that this is absolutely identifiable, because you can't say for certain that it didn't change because of the death that took place. One of them, the Tanakama, believes that it changes through death, and therefore you can't use it as an identifying mark. The other one believes, no, that these things don't change with death. They're still things that you can use to identify an individual even after death. Vika damre, and some say Amarava Dukuliyama Simanim Dirabanan. Everybody believes that the Simanim are Dirabanan, Vahocha, Bishuman siman muha kamiflege. Even if you believe that simanim are derabanan, there's certain simanim that are called simanim muvhakim. They are so good or such strong identifying features that we will believe that simanim muvhakim are deoraita. Even if you believe in general that simanim are derabanan, there's certain things that are so muvhak, so identifiable and so unique and so particular that they will be even midoraita. And that's what they're arguing here. Masav as siman muvhak. Masav alav siman muvhak. Is this birthmark, is this feature something that is so unique and so special that you can use that as an identifying feature or not? Dental records, certainly DNA, obviously, or things like that. It's like simon mufah. Ulach nlishna, the amar rava simanim deoraita. According to the lishna, the rava says that simanim are deoraita. Haktani, it says, afu pishye simanim begufo bekelav. What are you going to do with our Mishnah? If you believe that simanim are deoraita, how can our Mishnah say that you cannot identify the individual by simanim on his guf and simanim on his kelim? If simanim are deoraita, we should be able to release the wife based on the simanim of his guf. So he says, gufo daroch begotz. That the siman of guf was that he was tall or he was short. I mean that it's a siman that is not so unique to this individual. That's something that there are a lot of short people, a lot of tall people out there that really doesn't identify him. The kelav, chashinan l'sheila. By his clothing, we worry about the fact that somebody else borrowed the clothing. It might be somebody else borrowed his clothing and is dead with his clothing on. V'chashinan l'sheila. If that's the case, if you worry about people lending things out, chamor v'simanei ukaf heichim adrinan. A chamor, a donkey that has a saddle on it. If you have simanim on the saddle, you give it back in terms of aveda. How could you do that? Why can't you say that the saddle was borrowed? He borrowed the saddle, put it on the donkey, and the saddle and the donkey have nothing to do with each other. The saddle belongs to one guy, and the donkey belongs to the other guy. Why is that considered to be a siman? It says, "Lo shayli inche ukfa dig maskiv le lechamra." People don't lend out saddles from the donkey because they shape to the back of the donkey, and if you put a saddle from one onto the other, it scratches or it hurts, it wounds the donkey. So therefore, when a person gets the saddle down, they put it on and that's it. They don't start lending it out to other people or to other donkeys because otherwise they're going to cause problems both for the new donkey as well as the other donkey when they bring it back. So people don't lend it out. It's an object that is just not lent out. It's a kashur b'kisu b'arnaki b'tabat heichim adrinan. How can you give back something that is tied to another object like a wallet, a money pouch, or a ring or a signet or some identifying feature? Why don't we see again that it's Sheila? They lent it out to someone else. He lent his wallet. He lent his money pouch. He lent his signet to someone else. Kama says, people don't lend these objects out. Tabat, chayish lezyufe. Person doesn't lend out his signet or his chutam to someone else. Because, right, forgery. Someone else can then go stamp things and go come to his wife and say, look, your husband told me to give me all your property. I mean, that person can utilize that in the wrong manner, so you don't give it out. And that's why it's so interesting that we see that Achashverosh gives over his signet to Haman or to Mordechai. The Gemara in Megillah argues that whether he was a Melech Tipesh or Melech Chacham. I mean, in one sense, he plays off different characters against each other, so he utilizes them to his benefit, so he is smart in that way. But on the other hand, when you give over your signet, that means that people are doing something in your name, and you have no control over what they're doing in your name. Same thing happens with Yosef and Paro. When Paro gives the ring to Yosef, it's a way to show that Yosef can act on behalf of the king, and has the tokens as if the king said that. But that means whatever Yosef does is going to be now connected back to the king. So the same thing over here. People don't give out their rings because of that risk. Very interesting. People will not lend out their wallets or their money pouches. I think today people in general won't lend them out because they're very personal items. But over there they said because people are menachesh. People have superstitions about the fact that your mazel is connected to your wallet or to your money pouch. And if you lend it to someone else, that's going to take away your mazel and it's going to go to someone else. That's going to take away your parnosa or something like that. It's some sort of superstitious side to this. And therefore, they're not willing to lend out their wallets or their money pouches. Nothing to do with personal items, just because they feel like that there has a detrimental impact on their parnosa. V'baitema. And some say that our Mishnah is talking about kelav b'chivurei v'sumke. Talking about the clothing. What had you identify him? Oh, he's wearing white. He's wearing red. He's wearing colored clothing. Those are things like tall and short, which are just things that are not such simanim that you could rely on those simanim. So the Gemara gives answers both according to simanim deoraita as well as simanim derabanan. The only very interesting point here, and Tosfot raises the issue, is that by simanim, if you really believe simanim are derabanan, over here we have a Mishnah that tells us that if you find the get, with the wallet or with the tabat or with the money pouch that we allow the get to go through and say it's a good get. That means that we are matir erva based on simanim derabanan. Which means that you have a siman derabanan, and based on that siman derabanan, we're allowing the person to be matir and erva over here. How is that possible? So Tosafot over here grapples with this issue and trying to explain why by erva we're going to believe and by mamon we will not believe. He says that we only worry about Sheila when it comes to Isurim, but not to mamon or monetary items. Vim Tomar. So then if you say about all these items over here in terms of being Machzira Veda and the Chamor and all of these things, he says, Mil Domaskanat Shapir Lo Chashin Le Sheila Filu Bisur. So then he says, oh, in the end it works out well because we don't worry about lending out also by Isur. But he doesn't really deal with the issue in the interim, which is, okay, we had this case here in the interim of the Gemara where it thinks that you could meet the Rabbanan, you would be allowed to return it. So others say that the Chachamim over here, when allowing Simanim to return items, the Chachamim here worked on this premise of basically, Oker Kiddushim Meikara, that they were able to utilize that power of Hefker Beit Din Hefker, as well as utilizing, because in general, what the Rabbanan said is Simanim do work. We will have errors. We're going to have certain types of errors. In 90% of the time, we're going to get the item back to the right person when we use Simanim, and the Simanim Derabanan, we're going to use it. In Makom Isur, they're going to have to be mafil their power of either Hefker Beit Din Hefker, or they're going to have to say they're Oker Kiddushim Ikara, and allow it to go through in order to allow the Simanim to be used to make it functional, basically. Otherwise, it's going to be very hard to deal with returning things to people if you can't use Simanim, even if Simanim are not Deoraita. And Tosafot gives another answer here, which is that the original Havamim of the Gemara is that these items were found by someone else. And that's why you would have to invoke Simanim Deoraita versus Simanim Derabanan. Once we've concluded that it's Simanim Derabanan, he says that that explanation of that Braita will have to be where he finds it himself. Where he finds it himself, he has a Migo that he could have said they were never lost. He can say that he found it and it's his because he can identify the object that's tied to it. And that's how he's able to use it or utilize it even B'makom Isur, even though Simanim are Derabanan. V'afilu ra'o miguyad. L'memra de miguyad chaye. The fact that you see him already chopped up with a fatal injury indicates that we believe that there's a possibility that someone who is fatally injured here could actually survive. Because otherwise, why can't you testify about him? Veramini, Adam enu mitamei, achit teitzei nafsho. Person that does not mitamei, meaning tumata mate, until they die. Afilu miguyat, afilu goses. Even if he is fatally wounded, even if he's on his deathbed, then he still is not classified as being mitamei kemet. Gemara says, tumuye lo mitamei, he doesn't become tamei or doesn't make it tamei until he's dead. Hamichya lo chaye, but he certainly does not come back to life, he just still doesn't get up from that. All the Mishnah and all oath is trying to do is identify the point at which the tumah comes. That's at the point of death. But the Mishnah is not saying the reason you don't say that he's mitamei is because he may get up from this, he may live, he may survive this. That's not what it's saying. It's saying he's definitely going to die. But since he's definitely going to die, when is that point of death that makes him tamei? And that's only when he's absolutely dead. In this position of being right before death is not enough. But again, they don't suggest that the reasoning here is that maybe he will live, and that's why he's not mitamei. So you see from here that the Mishnah believes that he's not going to live. Now, as Tosafot does point out over here, the word goses means somebody on his deathbed. But the Gemara says about a goses on his deathbed, rov gosusim lemita, the majority of gosusim die. But that means that there is a minority that lives. So if you explain the Mishnah and although to mean that whoever is here definitely dies, then how do you reconcile that with our understanding of Goseis? The Tosafot over here says it must be your talking about a Goseis that's Miguyad. The reason they're on their deathbed is because they're Miguyad, and therefore this Goseis is an extension of the Miguyad and not your normal case of Goseis. So Rabbi Lokasha, Rabbi Shimon Elazar, Rabbonon. There's a difference. It's a Machloket Tanaim over here. Titania, Meidim al Miguyad. You can't testify with regards to a person who has a fatal wound that would otherwise make him a trefar people normally die from. You may not testify about the tzaluv. Again, the discussion that we had earlier about what tzaluv is, we'll assume that he is crucified. So Rabbi Shimon Elazar says, even on someone who is fatally wounded, we don't testify because it could constrict. Searing hotness causes a constriction of that area, and if it constricts, then he will be able to live because he won't bleed to death. Can we really set up the Mishnah like Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar? Because our Mishnah says you may not testify both about Mi'ad Yad and Saluf, which is the position of Rabbi Shimon Elazar, Haktani Seifa. The upcoming Mishnah has something in it that will not correlate with the position of Rabbi Shimon Elazar, which is Maseb Asya. There was this case out in Asya, something in Asia Minor, Bechad Shishil Shaluliyam. They had lowered him into the ocean for whatever reason to grab something, to get something down there. Velo altabi adam el raglo. And then they wheeled him back in afterwards. And when he came back in, all that was left was his leg. V'amru chachamim min arkova ulamalo. If what came back in was his leg above the knee, severed above the knee, tinasei, then his wife can get married because then he definitely died because that's a fatal wound. A fatal wound is when the leg is cut above the knee level. Min arkova lamato. If they only got back the piece of the leg that was below the knee, lo tinasei, his wife cannot get married because he could survive such a wound, and it was Mayim Shein Lam Sof. It was waters where they could not see all the banks around them, and maybe he was able to swim to safety or get out. Mar says, Shaini Maya Demirzu Mako. That maybe even Rabbi Shimon Elazar will agree with water, that water actually inflames or infects or makes worse the actual injury over here. That would probably be especially true if you're in salt water, that it causes that type of problem, and therefore it causes much more pain and damage, and therefore even Rabbi Shimon Elazar will agree in that case that it's not constricting to stop the bleeding, and therefore the person definitely died. So even Rabbi Shimon Elazar would agree with that position in the upcoming Mishnah. I saw this merchant, this Arab merchant, the Shakal Safsiro, took a sword, the guided the gamle, and he severed or cut his gamal, and it couldn't even get out its last bray before the camel was dead. So you see here that it's clear that this type of cut or this type of fatal wound is definitely deadly. And then why do you think that a person can survive it? So that gamal happened to be very weak. And that's why he actually killed it, because it wasn't useful anymore. He killed it. And since it didn't have the real strength of body, it couldn't survive that injury. Rav Amar, b'sakin milubenet v'direako. Rava says, no, you got the whole thing wrong here, because our Mishnah is in a case where we think that the person can survive. It's a case where they used a very, very hot sword or knife to cut the individual to create this injury. In that case, the searing hotness of the blade also causes a constriction of that area and allows the person to survive because they don't bleed to death. So in a case where they use this very hot item, that in itself, first of all, is much more sterile. And besides being sterile, it also causes a certain amount of healing in that area and allows it to constrict. And that's what it means here, that's Divrei Hakol. Divrei Hakol is that you don't have to make our Mishnah and the Mishnah and Holot be authored or have attribution to two different positions within the Tanaim. Everybody can agree. We can be in a case where they use the very hot item, like our Mishnah is in a case where they use the very hot knife or the sword. And that's why there's a possibility or plausibility that the person would survive. And that's why you can't testify about them. In the Mishnah and Olot, that's a case where they didn't use the hot sword, the hot knife, and therefore the person's going to die. And therefore we can make our Mishnah Divrei Hakol, because even the Chachamim will agree when you use the hot knife or sword, that there's a possibility of the person healing because of the way that the cut was done. And based on that, everybody could be the author of our Mishnah, not just Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. Now Tosfot over here says that this machloket about whether Miguyad is chaye or not between Rabbi Shimon Elazar and the Chachamim is not a fundamental machloket as whether to a person can survive this type of fatal wound, but how long they can live. And that's what Tosfot says over here. Aval enu davar barur shimot kodem shiteru alinisei. The fear that we have is that yes, he will die, and he certainly will die. The question is how long will it take him from this type of fatal wound to pass away? And the fear of Rabbi Shimon Elazar is that this fatal wound, he will live longer than we really think. And based on that, we will be matir his wife to get married before he actually dies. So again, if you wait a certain amount of time, for instance, you wait 12 months, then everybody would agree that the woman can get married because this is a fatal wound and there's no way he's going to survive 12 months. But if it's a shorter duration, then we have to worry about the fact that he might survive the wound. That's Rabbi Shimon Elazar's opinion, because the constriction of that area will allow him to live longer than we thought. And therefore, we can't have Matthew his wife until we either pass a long duration of time or until we have clear evidence of the fact that he died. You cannot testify when you see an animal eating him up if the injuries that he is sustaining right now from that wild animal is in a place where if a person loses that limb, they don't automatically die. But if the injury is in a place where a person dies from, if the injury is in his neck, in his head, in certain parts of the body where it would be impossible for him to recover from, then you can testify. If a person, if they shechted with him two of his simanim, meaning the esophagus and the windpipe, or the rove of those, ubrach, and then runs away, meidin, you're allowed to testify about that individual. Because even though he ran away at that time, there's no way that individual is going to survive. And the person goes ahead and he says right through his, can't talk anymore obviously because his head's been severed in some way, but he signals to the individuals, write a get for my wife. They can write it and they can give it as if he is still alive. So how can you say that for sure he's going to die and testify about it if you're telling me you're allowed to write a get on his behalf? Given what's happening here, the Gemara says, no, Chayu, you're right, he's alive right now, but Sofu Lamut. There's no way he's going to survive this injury. There's no way that he's going to live for a long duration. He might live for a short duration. Based on the fact that he lives for that short duration, gives you the ability to write the get as if he's alive. But in terms of testifying about this individual, you don't have to worry. You can testify that this individual is dead because there's no way they're going to survive this injury for a long duration. Oh, if that's the case, Yehei Golal Yado. Then why doesn't a person get galut if this happens? So in the cases of shogeg versus mezid, if a person does something intentionally and kills an individual intentionally, then they're chayav mita. Then if they do it accidentally, but accidentally that was preventable, an accident that was preventable, they go into galut. The Gemara in Makot spends a lot of time identifying exactly what are the parameters in which a person goes to galut. It has to be derech yirida, not derech aliyah. It has to be something where you're taking it down and the accident happened, not when you're taking it up. One of the cases there is where a person drops a knife and the knife happens to shech this individual. There, they don't go into galut. Now, if you for sure die from this, then why shouldn't the individual have to go into galut for this accident? Why do we have a brayta that says shechat shnayim or rov shnayim are zeinu golel? A person doesn't go into galut based on an accident that happens this way. It says ha'it marlam rabo shaya chashinan shema ruach bilbalto. We worry about the fact that the death was not caused solely by the shkita or the knife here, but his exposure to the wind or the elements, and that's what killed him. Inami shema ihu kirev mitato. Or maybe the person themselves brought the death upon themselves because they were mifarkes. They were moving around and shaking and moving, that it caused them to die faster. Now, Tosafot points out over here, these excuses are enough to get the person out of having to go to galut. But that does not make a person not culpable for killing an individual. If a person does this intentionally and checks the individual, cuts off their head in this manner, then the exposure to the wind or the pirkus, even if that accelerates the death for whatever reason, the person who did the killing or the severing is culpable and will be held accountable. Galut has certain parameters by which you have to be within that context to get galut. And it happens to be that if there are these other contributing factors, you won't go to galut. But that doesn't mean or doesn't have any implications the gabe mezin, the culpability for a person who kills in this manner. It's only unique to galut, which we mentioned before, that you only chayav galut if it's derech yirida, not derech aliyah. Even though by mezid, it wouldn't matter if it was aliyah or yirida, you would be held accountable for killing the individual. So this is something unique to galut. And the Gemara says, "May benayu." What's the difference between these two reasons? So the shechte bebeita the shisha. If he shechted him in a marble house where there is no exposure to the elements alav uperkis, and he shook himself out, but he ran around wherever he did over there. If the reason is because he moved and was mikarev his death, that would be there. On the other hand, if it has to do with the exposure to the elements, there is no exposure to the elements there. He nami the shechte bebara velo pirkis. He shechted him outside, but he didn't move at all. So again, there, if the elements are the issue, then that's what happened. The elements infected him over there. But if it has to do with the fact that he was mitkarev mitato because he moved around over there, he did not move around. Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava in our Mishnah says, lokol adam, lokol magom, lokol shod shavim. Not all the cases are the same. Gemara wants to know, Yibailu, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, the kula polik or the chumra polik? When Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava says not everything's the same, is it coming to say the kula? Meaning that you can even go beyond 3 days, or you can be missing features and still identify the individual. Oh, the Chumra Palik is only saying that maybe it's less than 3 days. You can't just use 3 days. So Gemara brings the Tashma. Tosfos points out the Gemara could have asked that he's also the Kula and the Chumra. Meaning that who says it has to be just the Kula or just the Chumra? It might be that he argues to both directions, both the Kula or the Chumra. In the end, it really doesn't matter because the Gemara's answer will not bring us to a conclusion about that. Now, therefore, the posing of that question would not help over here. Tashma. How Gavro the Tova Bikarme, person drowned in Karmi, Baskua Behadaya, Lebatra Tlatayomim, and they pulled him out in another location in Behadaya after 3 days. V'insaba Rav Dimi Minarda the Bitu. And Rav Dimi Minarda married off his wife after they pulled out the body 3 days later. Vitu. How Gavro the Atva Bidiglat, person drowned in Diglat, Vaskua Agishra Deshvistana, Vansava Robo the Bitu Apuma Deshushbine. And they pulled him out by the bridge in Shizbatano, and Rova married off his wife based on the identification of his best men, people who knew him very well, and they identified him, the Batar Chamisha Yome, after 5 days. So Yamar Bishlam Alakulo Palig, if you say that Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava is arguing even the Kula in Hudabi Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, then over here, Rav Dimi Min Arda and Rova were both using Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava's position, and they were paskening based on Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava. Yamar the Chumra Palig, if you say he only argues the Chumra, Inu David Kaman, who do they pass me like? The Gemara says that these cases are not good cases to prove anything about our Mishnah, because Shani Mayo Ditzamte, water constricts the body, and it preserves the body in the way that the features are identifiable, as opposed to when the body is out of the water, and in the heat, it begins to expand and to rot and decompose. There, you can't identify the body after the 3 days. In the water, because of the water being cooler and the nature of the water to cause constriction, therefore the body is identifiable even after a number of days. If you remember earlier, Tosafot quoted this to disagree with Rashi, to say that when it says that the women saw them the altar immediately, it wasn't they saw them immediately after they had died, but rather it was immediately after they were pulled out of the water. Because as long as they're in the water, there was no problem. As soon as they pulled them out of the water, then your clock starts to tick, and they need to identify them immediately, because if you keep them out of the water afterwards, even though in the water it constricts and maintains the integrity of the body, once they're taken out, then they're subject to the same bloating, swelling that happens to a normal body, and then they would not be identifiable. Rashi says that they pulled them out immediately, meant literally out of the water. But based on this Gemara, Tosafot says they don't have to pull them out of the water immediately, just they have to identify them immediately after they came out of the water. Mar says, Va'amar, didn't you say before, Maya Mirzumako? Didn't you just say before that the water inflames, infects, or worsens the condition of a wound? It says, Hanimile Echadikamako. That's when there is a wound on the body. But when there is no wound on the body, it causes the body to constrict and preserves the body. So if there's a wound on the body, then it causes the wound to become even worse. On the other hand, if there is no wound on the body, the water helps to preserve the integrity of the body, and therefore the body will remain identifiable. And you can also differentiate between just the wound and the whole body. I mean that the wound will be made worse by being in the water, which means that the person won't survive. It doesn't mean that the body itself then will lose its integrity just because there is a wound on it, but the assumption of the Gemara is that that is the case. And therefore, if the body is whole, then the water will preserve it. If the body has some sort of wound in it, then the water causes much more damage to the body. And that's what Tosafot quoted earlier, that's only true when they pulled them out of the water, you saw them within that time frame, within a reasonable period of time. But if you pulled them out of the water and then they stayed around on the banks or in the heat, then these bodies will swell like any other body would swell, and then they won't be identifiable anymore. So just because they're in the water, that's not a permanent mummification of the bodies, that the integrity of the body stays, but rather, it's just as long as they're in the water, they're preserved. And when you take them out, you can identify them as if that was the point of death. But once they've come out of the water, then they're subject to the same rules of nature as any other body that decomposes with the heat. And maybe even from this Gemara, it happens even a little faster, because here the Gemara does not give the 3 day window. It just says that b'shate, you have to see them almost immediately or within the close time frame to when they are pulled out of the water. Okay, we're going to stop over here by the Mishnah on the top of Kuf Chaf Aleph Amud Aleph.